Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, QAnon has grown significantly in the last few years. We'll explore a new book that explains the conspiracy theory with the authors. But first, California's recall process is broken. It may well be unconstitutional and undemocratic. With the upcoming recall election, we'll explore these issues and discuss potential reforms.
I'm Doug Becker. On Tuesday, September 14th, California voters are tasked with choosing whether to recall their current governor, Gavin Newsom, and replace him with one of 46 candidates of varying experience and seriousness. This process has uncovered a serious challenge to the governability of the state based on, ironically, its progressive history and mechanisms that were originally seemingly put in place to ensure democracy. But from a wide-ranging practice of the use of state-level propositions to this admittedly bizarre recall process, the state faces a governability crisis. On today's show, we will discuss the recall process, whether or not it's constitutional, whether or not it's democratic, and whether this process, again, intended to promote direct democracy, is actually undermining democracy within the state. Our guests are Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean and Jesse H. Choper Distinguished Professor of Law at UC Berkeley Law School. He's the author of We the People, a Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century, and his latest Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. And Henry Brady, the former dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and professor of political science and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the co-author of Unequal and Unrepresented, Political Inequality and the People's Voice in the New Gilded Age, and The Unheavenly Chorus, Political Voice and the Promise of American Democracy. Thank you both for joining us. Erwin Chemerinsky, I will start with you. Is this recall process, is it even constitutional?
I think the process that's set out by the California Constitution violates the United States Constitution. If Gavin Newsom loses in the recall election, it's likely that 48 or 49% of the people will want to stay as governor. On the other hand, when it comes to the second question on the ballot, according to current polls, the person to be chosen will get about 18%. So what we'll end up with is a governor favored by 18%, chosen over someone favored by 48 or 49%. Not only is that nonsensical, but it's also unconstitutional. My colleague Aaron Edlin and I wrote a couple of op-eds explaining this. The Supreme Court for over half a century has stressed one person, one vote. Everyone should have an equal say in determining the results of an election. This is an election to decide who's the governor. To allow 18% to control over the wishes of 48 or 49% is inconsistent with that constitutional principle.
And so with that in mind, Henry Brady, is this democratic?
It's not democratic either. And part of what Erwin just said shows you that. There's just so many peculiarities to this law. It is the easiest recall procedure amongst all the 19 states that even have recalls. And second of all, it's got this bizarre situation where you have the two questions. Only Colorado does it the same way. And let me just go through that quickly, what that involves. First, how easy it is. In eight states, you have to actually say that the governor has committed some malfeasance, or he or she is incompetent, or something that really indicates something really bad about the governor. In California, you just have to say, hey, I really don't like the guy. That's really what it amounts to. Second of all, you can do it at any time during the period during which the person is governor. In Michigan, you can't do it in the first year or the last year of the governor's term. And that's essentially to avoid frivolous elections. Third, you actually don't have to get but 12% of the people who voted in the last gubernatorial election. And most states go to about 25%, 11 of the 19 states. So that's a really low figure. And then finally, you have a situation where, you can choose your timing such that you can actually choose a time where you can get the election held, as it is being done right now, when there's going to be low turnout. And essentially choosing a time when there's going to be low turnout, you ensure that only the very, very intense people, And that tends to be the people who are unhappy about the result of the last gubernatorial result that they're going to vote. Whereas those folks who were pretty happy with the governor and felt that the governor was just fine are less likely to vote. And so the net result is that in all those ways, this is undemocratic, just in terms of getting it on the ballot. And then we got this ballot, which leads to the situation that Irwin described, where the governor, sitting governor, could get literally just one vote less than 50%. And then the person who wins on the second question could get even less than 18%, could get 10%, 5%, almost anything is possible, but certainly something that one could not consider a Democratic majority. So there's much better ways to do this, and almost every state does it in much better ways. And I can talk more about that if you want to know.
But Irwin, my understanding of this recall process was that it has its roots in progressive politics from about 100 years ago, and that California has a number of mechanisms, including the proposition system, that's designed to try to break the power of political elites and return democracy, you know, back to the people. Is that what was intended? And if so, how the process becomes so altered?
You're right. The recall procedure, like the initiative process, stems from the progressive era. It was a way of empowering the people. I think it's important to note that until 2003, there hadn't been a recall of a governor. And so people didn't focus on how this was set up by the California Constitution. Some of the problems are in the California Constitution. Some of the problems are in the statutes that implement it. So Henry's right, it takes only 12% of the voters in the last election to get a recall on the ballot. In most other states that have recalls, it's 33% or even 40%. That's the statutes. I think that after the last recall election, people just didn't pay attention to it, didn't cure the process. And my hope is that whatever happens on September 14th, we're gonna take action at least to amend the election code to change the procedures that can be modified that way. But I would hope we'd also change the California Constitution to create a much more rational process. I don't think it's reasonable or necessary to end the recall process, but I think Henry has outlined the kind of reforms that we need, both in the statutes and in the California Constitution.
So when you're talking about the 12% threshold, is that the number of signatures that's required in order to trigger the recall? Because I know one of the things that's been striking to me is this is not the first attempt to even have a petition to recall Gavin Newsom, correct? There have been numerous petitions and this one just happened to take hold?
Essentially, every governor for decades has had attempts on the part of people to get a recall petition put together. The trouble is, it used to be that it required sort of formal organizing and really sort of people who were truly sort of concerned about what was going on. Now it turns out you can get companies to go and collect signatures for you. And if you actually have a lot of money, you can get a petition put in place, which is essentially what was done in this case. Let me just say what's odd about all this is that the progressive era reforms were put in place because of the concern about the railroads in California and their tremendous control of the state legislature. In fact, the wonderful novel on this is Frank Norris, The Octopus, which is well worth reading about California and what happened down near Bakersfield. At that time, the only way that popular will could be expressed would be through some kind of populist movement where people got together, and it really was a way to stop the corporations from having so much power. But now, it turns out, actually, it's been turned on its head. A lot of these mechanisms turn out to be ways that corporations or intense parties can have a way to overturn processes that were truly democratic. And that's really not what they were meant to do. And so it's not just that it's a very odd statute and a very odd way to do things. It's also that it turns out it just doesn't do what it once was intended to do.
Irwin, if we go back to this question about financing, then, is what's really striking me. Because again, the progressive era was really about trying to break the financial powers through some sort of popular movement. But it seems that's been one area this has really been turned on its head, that this opens the door where some well-financed campaign is able to hire these firms, and those of us out here in California know that there's a kind of cottage industry of people who just kind of are always around asking for signatures to put something on a ballot. Is this really been driven by a pretty small number of sort of moneyed interests?
Yes, I think you've got to realize that in this instance, the recall is an effort by the Republicans to gain the governorship, knowing that they're extremely unlikely to win in November 2022. It goes to something that Henry was saying, that if this was on the ballot the next regularly scheduled election, given the Democratic versus Republican reservation in California right now, Gavin Newsom would clearly win. The Republicans don't perceive it's likely that they will have a candidate who can defeat Gavin Newsom. And it's not very far from now, just 14 months from now. So their strategy is have a recall on a random Tuesday in September, that those who oppose Gavin Newsom are much more likely to turn out to vote. And this gives them a chance to be able to win the governorship that they otherwise couldn't do. One of the things that troubles me statewide is the impetus of those who lose, sometimes in a close election, to then try to undo that by a recall. So we're seeing in Los Angeles County the effort to recall Los Angeles District Attorney George Gascon, who won in a close election. There's a recall effort in San Francisco with regard to this attorney, Chase Boudin. It was just a couple of years ago that we had a recall of a judge in California for the first time since the early 1930s because people didn't like his sentence in a particular case. One thing that I would like to see, in addition to increasing the number of signatures, is requiring bipartisan support to get a recall on the ballot. If you think about a meeting under Robert's Rules of Order, you have to vote in the majority in order to ask for reconsideration of a decision. It looks like of the signatures that came in for this recall, less than 6% came from registered Democrats.
So that becomes kind of second bite of the apple, if you will, a second crack at an election at a time when we as a country have been wrestling with, you know, relitigating the last election constantly as opposed to looking forward. Is this kind of a logical extension of some of these other broader national trends? Henry Gray, I'll ask you.
I think it's part of what we're seeing, which is that in all sorts of different arenas, and sadly, it's the Republican Party that has decided that it often can't win a majority, and therefore it has to find ways to suppress majorities. There's actually a stream of thought within the Republican Party that argues this is really a good thing. And the stream of thought goes along the lines of, well, there are the people who are the good and the smart and the thoughtful people. And those people should be ensured that they can get a chance to have disproportionate influence, because you certainly don't want the people who aren't so good and so thoughtful to be voting. It's a very, discriminatory kind of perspective on democracy. Democracy, from my perspective, means that everybody has the right to vote. And I believe that really strongly. It may be true that there are some people with more education and know more about some things than other things. But what people individually do know is they know about their own concerns and interests. And it should be the case that they get a chance to express those concerns and interests in a system that's not rigged so that their concerns and interests are simply not recorded. And that's where we are right now. We've got a situation where the Republican Party simply doesn't think that there's a group, that they think a certain group of the population do not deserve, for various reasons, to have their concerns recorded in elections. And I think that's horrible for democracy. And in fact, it leads us towards something more like autocracy, or at least an aristocracy, where certain people have many, many, many more rights than others.
You listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing the California recall election, the statutes and the constitutional provisions within the state, and whether it is constitutional and whether it's democratic. Our guests are Erwin Chemerinsky of the UC Berkeley School of Law and Henry Brady of the UC Berkeley School of Public Policy. Now, one thing that's unique, or seemingly unique, and we can get into how other states have done this, but Erwin, I would think that if a governor was recalled, in particular in a state where the lieutenant governor is actually elected independent of the governor, why is there the second question? Why not just the governor's recalled, the lieutenant governor should become governor, right?
I think that's exactly right. And I think it would be better to take an amendment of the California Constitution to say, if the governor is recalled, the lieutenant governor takes over. if Gavin Newsom leaves office for any other reason, the lieutenant governor succeeds him. It makes no sense to say we're going to have an election and simultaneously decide whether to recall him and choose his successor. And the reason that makes no sense is that strong candidates aren't going to want to run not knowing whether the recall is going to succeed or fail. No viable Democrat is on that list. Last time, Cruz Bustamante put himself on the list, but it was also political suicide for him to do so, and it became a lesson to Democrats this time around.
Cruz Bustamante, by the way, was lieutenant governor at the time.
Yes.
So he was at least on the list, but as you say, it was the end of his career.
But one of the things that kind of saved the 2003 process and at least carried some vestige of legitimacy is the fact that the candidate that got the most votes for governor, Arnold Schwarzenegger, actually got more votes than Gray Davis. So that argument was undermined. That's not likely to happen this time around, is it, Henry?
No, not at all. As Erwin said earlier, that right now, just to give some basic figures, the state's about 47% Democrat. And it's about 24% Republican. So to begin with, it's a very highly Democratic state. Second of all, the polls show very clearly that at least right now, it looks like likely voters, about 55-56% will vote no on the recall and therefore endorse Gavin Newsom. Now, it's possible because of low turnout and other problems that just could fall slightly below 50%. But then you go to the candidates on the list and the highest figures for the people on that list are Larry Elder, and nobody's shown a MIA poll that has more than about 25% for Larry Elder, and it's likely he'll get less than that. And so, in effect, what Gavin Newsom could get twice the vote against the recall, that the person who ends up as the governor, if Newsom falls short of 50%, and then the person who then gets the most votes on the second question, that's just really crazy.
There's one other thing, Erwin, about this process that has left me kind of scratching my head, because certainly a lot of the grievances against the 2020 election that the Republicans had leveled is that the rules changed as a result of the pandemic, that there was an expansion of vote by mail, you know, et cetera. But on this recall election, didn't the same thing happen where there was an extension given to secure enough signatures? And if I remember correctly, the pandemic was actually cited as a reason for that, right?
That's exactly right. And many believe that Gavin Newsom made a mistake in not objecting to that. I would go back and I question the premise you started with, that there had been those kinds of changes with regard to the 2020 election. In fact, the Supreme Court prevented the federal courts from imposing changes that I think should have been done to facilitate voting in a pandemic. But yes, as to this recall election, the court extended the time for getting signatures, and Gavin Newsom, maybe out of a commitment to democracy, maybe an error, didn't object, and it made all the difference.
Yeah, and by the way, California already has one of the longest periods you can collect signatures, which is 5 months, whereas most states are 2 or 3 months. So that's just another way in which it's very easy to get a recall petition on the ballot. And why do you want to make that hard? Well, you want to make that hard because you just don't want frivolous groups putting forth petitions for recall. Recall is a very serious thing. And we want to make sure that, in fact, there's a significant group of people who feel that there's a problem before we go and have an election. And by the way, it's also very costly. We're talking hundreds of millions of dollars to have this election.
And Henry Brady, to follow that up, you talked about how other states have done recalls. What are some of the more standard practices that other states have? I mean, obviously, a couple we could probably predict is the lieutenant governor becoming governor, but are there some other kind of standard practices?
Yeah, so the two major practices are the lieutenant governor becoming governor. The second practice is that you just have a unified ballot. And whoever gets the most votes, that's the person that wins. You don't have this two ballot scheme, which, as I say, we only share with Colorado, and it is a very, very strange scheme given the way it can work out.
So does that mean then, in that case, Gavin Newsom would be on the ballot, and if he got
be on the ballot,
he would win?
There'd be one ballot. It would be a whole list of people. There'd be Gavin Newsom and a lot of other folks, and you could choose which of those people you would vote for. And presumably, again, suppose Gavin Newsom ends up getting less than 50%, but he gets 48%, and the second choice person, Larry Elder, say gets 25%, well, then Newsom would win because he got 48 and Elder got 25%. Furthermore, you could even think about doing ranked choice voting. And so in that case, you could eliminate people who get small numbers of votes, reallocate those votes, and eventually get to a majority so that we actually have a majority result. That's perfectly feasible with modern computers and modern voting methods. I'm not so sure, by the way, Erwin, it'd be interesting to discuss whether it should be the lieutenant governor or whether it should be the method I just described where you have one unified ballot.
If we want to keep the recall system, what would make this more democratic, Erwin?
I think we will keep the recall system. I think there is a chance we could get people to amend the Constitution, get the legislature to change the statutes. I don't think that it's likely that people would vote themselves out of power and eliminate the recall. One possibility is just to have the lieutenant governor see the governor. Another is what Henry suggests of a unified ballot. But I also think over the course of this half hour, we've identified many other changes that there need to be. Increase the number of signatures that are necessary to get a recall on the ballot. Shorten the amount of time for gathering those signatures. I'd like to see some requirement for bipartisan support, needing a certain threshold of registered voters from both parties. Have the recall held at the next scheduled election, not, as I said, the random Tuesday in September. Change who succeeds the governor if there is a recall. And I'm ambivalent whether it is the lieutenant governor or a unified ballot. Some of these would take constitutional amendments. Some could be done by statutes. But I hope we all learn a lesson from September 14th. We don't want to go through this process again a year, 2 years, 5 years from now.
Last question here, and we referenced this when you said that kind of the more serious candidates, the more experienced candidates, et cetera, would tend to steer clear of this. Most of the main Republican candidates who we anticipate would be the Republican nominee in 2022. So there's a note that we're going to have another election coming up in slightly over a year. Most of them are on the ballot though, aren't they? But I know from other things I've read is that they're on the ballot, but they really haven't organized much of a campaign. How much is this a huge challenge that the whole process becomes kind of like a circus where the candidates who are attempting, you know, to run aren't necessarily serious candidates? Or has this been much more of an organized, you know, campaign on the part of the Republican Party in an attempt to try to replace Gavin Newsom early?
Yeah, I mean, if you want an amusing few hours, read all the bios of the people who are running for the governorship on the second ballot. I mean, some of them are really, you know, it's sort of basically people saying, well, have a nice day. And it's embarrassing for many of those people. It's indeed true that the folks who you might think would be Republican candidates in the next election are running. And I think it's easier for Republicans to run than Democrats. But again, if you had a situation where you had a unified ballot, then obviously the obvious Democrat, which would be the current governor, unless the current governor was so embarrassed by some situation. I mean, we can't imagine a situation in which a governor has done something that we all think is so awful that we really don't want to retain that governor. And if the legislature refuses to impeach the governor, then we would want to have a mechanism where we could rid ourselves of that governor. And so the recall does have a purpose, but it should be based upon fairly severe violations of our trust and of the responsibility that the governor has.
And of course, as a reminder, we've seen a governor acting in a way that was deserving of being removed, and New York was fully capable of getting rid of their governor without going through this recall.
But the recall, especially when you have, as we have, highly democratic legislatures, you could see a circumstance where it's possible that although in New York they actually acted responsibly, but it's possible that they might not in California for some reason, in which case you would want to have the additional opportunity to bring the people into the situation so that in fact you could rid yourself of that person.
But it has to be structured so it's the last resort. Mm-hmm. Where the other mechanisms don't work. What we do in California is make it so easy, it's not a last resort at all. It's a chance for a political party that couldn't otherwise win to try to use this mechanism, or for those who lose a close election to try to undo it.
Now, if the likely outcome of this election, if the polls are accurate, that Newsom ends up not being recalled, and we come to the conclusion that this was just a big waste of time and perhaps even more so of money, do you anticipate that there's going to be a desire to try to change the Constitution? Or is there going to be kind of a sense of, hey, we survived this one, so there's no need to change the process, Henry?
I think there's going to be an attempt. I've been talking to a lot of people around the state about this, and I think there's a lot of folks who are saying, we got to do something about this. There was, by the way, a good New York Times editorial which talked about changing the process here in California. I think absolutely that folks are going to get together and they're going to say something's got to be done here because this is a bit of an embarrassment.
And Erwin, sort of the last word here, is the lesson here that something that was intended to be a process of direct democracy can always be manipulated by moneyed interests to try to serve their own interests? Or am I being too cynical about the whole process?
Yeah. I'm uncomfortable generalizing. This is a process that was created over a century ago. I think the most that I would say is there can often be unintended consequences to things that are set up. And I don't think anyone, when they created this process, envisioned the type of situation that we're facing right now, that you could have someone end up with 48 or 49% of the voters wanting the individual stay in office and a candidate favored by 18 or 20% replacing them. We've seen that's a realistic possibility, even if it doesn't happen. I agree with Henry. It's got to be the impetus for reform.
And with that, I want to thank our guests. We've been discussing the constitutionality and the democratic implications of the California recall process and the upcoming California recall election. Our guests have been Erwin Chemerinsky, Dean, and Jesse H. Choper, Distinguished Professor of Law at UC Berkeley Law School. He's the author of We the People, a Progressive Reading of the Constitution for the 21st Century, and Presumed Guilty, How the Supreme Court Empowered the Police and Subverted Civil Rights. And Henry Brady, former Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy and Professor of Political Science and Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the co-author of Unequal and Unrepresented, Political Inequality and the People's Voice in the New Gilded Age, and The Unheavenly Chorus, Political Voice and the Promise of American Democracy. Thank you both very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
When we come back, pastels and pedophiles. What goes on inside the mind of QAnon? Stay with us. You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Donald Trump may be out of office, but the conspiracy theory around QAnon continues to affect the country. What's so appealing about the theory? And what can be done to remedy the problems it's causing? Doug Becker explores these issues and more.
I'm Doug Becker. Conspiracy theories have marked American politics throughout the nation's history, from accusations against Masons, anti-Semitic stories about Jewish cabals, the nation has frequently seen small groups of citizens appearing to accept some truly salacious and damning accusations about the government. The most recent dive into conspiracy is centered around a shadowy figure posting to the internet with the pseudonym Q. The conspiracy is known as QAnon, and it poses a challenge for both law enforcement as well as political discourse. A new book entitled Pastels and Pedophiles, Inside the Mind of QAnon, explores this conspiracy theory and its adherents. We have its authors on the show today. Mia Bloom is Professor of Communication and Middle East Studies at Georgia State University. Along with this book, she's the author of Bombshell, Women in Terror, and Small Arms, Children in Terror. and Sofia Moskalenko. She's a psychologist connected as a research fellow for evidence-based cybersecurity group at Georgia State University. And she studies mass identity, intergroup conflict, and conspiracy theories. And again, along with this book, she's written Friction, How Conflict Radicalizes Them and Us, and The Marvel of Martyrdom, The Power of Self-Sacrifice in a Selfish World. Thank you both for joining us. This is a really fascinating book on this conspiracy that's really made its way into the popular press and into the popular discourse. So Mia Bloom, what exactly is QAnon?
Thank you for having us. QAnon, if you haven't heard of it because you've been under a rock or something, people talking a lot about QAnon. And what QAnon is, it's a baseless conspiracy theory that began on the internet that makes allegations that there is a global cabal of child trafficking pedophiles who are also drinking their blood. And the pedophile has been manipulating history and politics for as long as they can remember. And that the cabal is comprised mostly of Democrats and Hollywood elites, but also includes some prominent royal families in the UK, in Holland, but a few Republicans as well. So the argument is that not only are these, is the cabal trafficking the children, they are raping the children and drinking their blood. And what it is in many respects is it's a rehashed version of some anti-Semitic tropes, some anti-Catholic tropes, and conspiracies that have been around for a very long time that have just sort of gotten a new life as adjacent or part of QAnon.
And Sofia Moskalenko, is it fair to say that QAnon is sort of part of this is what's old is new again? Is there anything new with this QAnon conspiracy compared to some of the historical conspiracies the US has experienced?
So there are several things that are unprecedented, very unique to QAnon. The most glaring thing is, of course, the internet and the ability it brings to connect so many people so fast. So before, for example, with the protocols of Elders of Zion, the canonical anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, they were copied by hand in the times before Xeroxes. And of course it took time, and then it took time to, translate them into different languages and bring them physically from one place to another. Whereas with QAnon, it's literally in the palm of your hand, day or night, very easily accessible in different versions, different degrees of depth that you're interested in. So one is just how viral it is, if you will. Another new thing is how many different conspiracies are accumulated under this one umbrella of QAnon. So you have, of course, the blood-drinking, Satan-worshipping pedophiles, but then you also have lizard people, this idea of lizard-human hybrids that are malicious and are going to take over the world. You have space lasers controlled by Jews that are burning out forests in California. You have flat earth, you have 5G, you have microchips and vaccines and COVID denialism at the same time as you have a conspiracy theory that COVID was actually designed as a bioweapon in the lab. So it's very diverse. Occasionally it's self-contradictory and or absurd. And another interesting thing is that, there are some pockets of QAnon believers that believe in completely different conspiracy theories. So somebody might be a firm believer in COVID as a biological weapon, and they don't believe anything about flat earth or space lasers or lizard people and vice versa. So it's a very inclusive, very grassroots movement that affects in the US alone, something like 30 million adults. So hugely, hugely successful in terms of attracting people and keeping them in the movement. And I don't think we can point to a time in history where conspiracy theory just swept quite as broad a population quite as quickly, because QAnon is only a couple of years old and it really didn't take off until the COVID lockdown. So we're looking at a very short time frame for it to have become this massive, huge phenomenon.
So Mia Bloom, to try to explain what is the QAnon conspiracy is really particularly challenging, right? Because it's sort of like a basket of conspiracies that are all kind of thrown in together, are there any consistencies that we can say, maybe there's a couple of key points that make something Q? Are we using broadly anything that's conspiracy theory and kind of folding it into something we call Q?
Well, so what QAnon has been able to do, as Sophia was saying, that is so unique, is it has managed to embrace a number of previous conspiracy theories that in many ways were stovepipe. So people who believed that the moon landing was fake or that 9/11 was an inside job, they tended not to communicate with each other. They had very separate identities. And what QAnon has managed to do is stitch together a lot of these pre-existing conspiracy theories. So for example, Sophia mentioned lizard people. That's been around since 1999. And QAnon only emerges in October of 2017. But it also brought in Pizzagate, which predates QAnon. And so if anything is commensurate or consistent or can have some overlap, this is where QAnon in many ways metastasizes. So for example, the lizard people conspiracy argues that the Rothschild family has been in cahoots with the alien space lizards, and it's very anti-Semitic. And so they have that in common, the anti-Semitism and the antagonism towards Rothschild. Or in some of the other conspiracy theories, they blame George Soros. And so George Soros becomes the common element. And so while not every single person who subscribes to QAnon believes every single element of it, well, they have the one consistent part that they believe that there is a cabal that is, you know, pulling the strings and manipulating things and is trafficking in children. And then it might be some other elements of these pre-existing conspiracies that are adjacent or commensurate. So that's the unique part. The unique part as well, as Sophia was mentioning, was that the pandemic afforded an environment that created sort of the perfect storm. On the one hand, we know from research people like Joe Lucinski in Florida has done about conspiracy theories and Brendan Nyhan at Dartmouth, that people tend to find conspiracy theories a lot more comforting than the unknown. So for example, you know, someone gets hit by a bus crossing the street, and that's a terrible tragedy. And it's just so random. But if you think the bus driver was aiming for them, then that makes sense. And so for whatever reason, even though, you know, thinking that there's a plan, even an evil plan, provides people more comfort than thinking that these bad things happen to good people and there's no explanation for it. So then you have a virus that you cannot see, that at least initially we didn't know exactly how it was transmitted. And so we were getting, like, inadvertently, because first we'd have data from China, but China had a very different population. Then we had data from Italy, and they had different characteristics. And so we didn't know a lot about COVID-19 at the outset. When the lockdowns first happened, we have this unknowable disease. We're going to the internet to find out more information. At the same time, disinformation is being amplified by China and Russia. And so all of these things together made the interest in the QAnon conspiracy theory, according to the Wall Street Journal, increase by 600%. And so we see that, you know, the interest in QAnon from October 2017 until the pandemic was a relatively flat slope. And then all of a sudden you have this massive uptick in interest, and it corresponds to the lockdowns. And of course, we started to see the metastasis of the conspiracy starting to include things like being anti-mask and pressuring states to open early before, you know, it was ready. And then after Donald Trump, mysteriously, according to QAnon, who was supposed to win, loses the election, it pivots to then be about the Dominion voting machines. And so part of this is seeing how in real time, social media, because of the algorithms of pulling people further and further down rabbit holes, functioned in the worst possible way, but also it's the perfect storm of people at home, online more, either because all of our classes were online, our jobs were online, and at the same time, there's a health pandemic, there's a racial justice pandemic, there's a pandemic where people, you know, in terms of economics, a lot of people were losing their jobs, so there was economic insecurity, all of these things at the same time. It's not a good mix. And the result was potentially, if these polls that have come out from AEI, which is the American Enterprises Institute, a conservative think tank, or the Institute for the Study of Religion, they have polled people, and it's about 15 to 17% of people believe in this global conspiracy. If that is representative, a sample of the United States, that's where Sophia is getting, you know, as many as 30 million Americans.
Yeah, it's really quite striking. And Sophia, you've described this as almost remarkably democratic because you've got all these different conspiracies floating around and all online. Is there a leadership structure at all to QAnon? I know the book goes into some question about who Q is, and then you kind of dismiss this going, who Q is probably is not that important. But the broader question then is, who's organizing this? Who's driving this?
This is another interesting thing about QAnon, especially for us, for me and myself, who came into the QAnon environment from studying radical groups and terrorist groups. Of course, we were looking for leadership, right? We were looking for structured hierarchy, some sort of top-down relation of priorities and information and so on. Since we started looking into that, several journalistic, serious deep dives into this question came out. So the HBO did a documentary, Vice did a series about who Q is. And the best we can tell is it's not one person. It's several people who posted as Q. We also know that there are some influential political figures who greatly helped to spread the message of Q. So whenever Donald Trump liked or reposted something, or General Flynn or Lynn Wood, their immense followers got very excited about it. And then it just spread like wildfire. And so these are not necessarily leaders in the sense that they come up with an agenda, but they definitely are charismatic representatives of this movement that brings people into it and keeps people in it who are already inside it. For myself, because I'm interested in mass psychology, it's not so interesting who Q is, because at any given moment in time, there were people or groups who advanced these crazy, you know, conspiracy theories, these like ideas about dismantling the existing systems. And it's only when the broader society was ready for these ideas and interested in investing their time and their well-being in it, that it made any difference. And so I am more interested in what it is that made, especially the American public, but really QAnon, we see gaining movement all over the world, right? But especially so in the United States. To me, the more interesting question is, what made the American public so receptive to this message, despite its many limitations, right? What is it that makes our friends and neighbors and colleagues and family members who we've known all their life and thought of them as logical, reasonable people, now speak about lizard people and space lasers and 5G and all of that stuff? That's the question that interests me more.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. We're discussing a new book that's been published on QAnon entitled Pastels and Pedophiles, Inside the Mind of QAnon, with the authors Mia Bloom and Sophia Moskalenko, both connected with Georgia State University. Mia, one of the really striking things about this book and really got me thinking about QAnon has been this gender component, that there seems to be more women, you know, who are followers of it. And though we've mentioned people like Michael Flynn or even Donald Trump, the two most visible figures in government today associated with QAnon are women, are Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert. So what is it about this Q conspiracy that seems to be appealing more to women, sort of the gendered component of this conspiracy?
Because Sophia and I have both been studying, I mean, between the two of us, we have about 5 decades worth of research on terrorism. One of the areas that I've written on, and in fact, I have another book coming out eventually, I'm not sure when, on women and terrorism, was we saw how ISIS appealed to women. You know, ISIS, at the height of the caliphate in 2015, 2016, it was pulling in women from 80 different countries. And the way that they appeal to young women, including, you know, those girls that disappeared from London, from Bethnal Green Academy, was, did you want to help the orphans in Syria? And the question is always going to be, of course, you want to help orphans. Who says no to that question? And do you want to help the orphans in Syria? For me, resonated very similarly, like, did you want to save the children? And that was a campaign that the QAnon basically stole from the actual charity that is in the UK and in the US called Save the Children. And they took the hashtag and they ran with it. And of course, piggybacking, you know, it's almost like they kidnapped the hashtag, if you will, but piggybacking on the excellent reputation of an organization that protected children all over the world, but overwhelmingly in the global South. And so what ended up happening is that that appealed to a particular kind of female. And it just so happens, and we just did a study to, because, you know, when we wrote the book, we didn't have the data yet. We have the data now that white suburban women who had in many ways stopped voting Republican in the 2018 midterms, which is one of the reasons why the Democrats were able to retake the House or maintain the House, but also get close to retaking the Senate. And then finally in January with the runoff, we able to get 50 in the Senate, was white suburban women had stopped supporting Donald Trump. And this campaign in many ways appealed to white suburban women so that in 2020, more white women voted for Donald Trump than in 2016, despite their lower numbers in the 2018 midterms. And part of it to, you know, like, how do we explain this? And, you know, I worked with an Americanist to be able to crunch the numbers in ways that I cannot with t-tests and various sophisticated methodologies that I do not have. Basically, talking about saving the children and all the images of the children were white children who were looked like they were terrified or who were bound or bruised or beaten. This, I think, appeal to women at a very basic level. And, you know, and again, I apologize to the postmodern and the gender studies people, but the reason that it's a stereotype is because, in fact, it does appeal to women to have a maternal instinct, whether you have kids or not. But this idea of wanting to help kids. And so in some ways, it's appealing to someone's innate altruism in a way that, you know, let's go get them, let's cut off heads, didn't work for women the way ISIS had worked for men, but let's help the children really pulled women in. And so helping children, especially now, this is not to say men don't also have a paternal instinct, but I think we tend to associate it more with women. And what we saw was that although Save the Children, the charity, overwhelmingly depicts children of color, because where are they operating? Middle East, Southeast Asia, Latin America. In other words, Africa, most of the kids that they help are in other parts of the world where it's not white. Whereas the QAnon Save the Children campaign was 87% white and showed kids that were terrified. And one of the things that was most disturbing, and it's something that, you know, we're doing, because you're an academic, you understand this, we're doing the revise and resubmit to get the publication out for Stanford soon, that there was this meme that they used repeatedly of a child who was terrified because there's a large hand covering their mouth so they can't scream. And in 9 of the 10 instances of this version, the child is white and the hand is black or brown. And so that really does build on pre-existing racist tropes, going back to the Klansman in 1905 with, you know, D.W. Griffiths wrote Birth of a Nation based on the Klansman, that black and brown men are coming for your white daughters. And so that really did appeal to a particular kind of white, conservative, suburban voter, brought them right back to Donald Trump. And I think that that's part of it. I think just this idea that the worst thing you can call someone is to call them a pedophile. In fact, it's one of the reasons why they are constantly attacking Joe Biden and Hunter Biden as being pedophiles. When in fact, the irony is that Matt Gaetz and, you know, they have in their midst people who are actually being accused or investigated for pedophilia. So it's the craziest version of projection I've ever seen.
And Sophia, kind of partially as a follow-up to your question or your statement about how generally rational people, you know, can find themselves being drawn into this conspiracy. I think of not just the children angle, which of course is essential, but the human trafficking angle. I know groups that work on human trafficking have been very concerned that QAnon has taken this issue and made it really complicated, action on this. But certainly one of the most appealing aspects of the QAnon conspiracy is we're all concerned with questions of human trafficking and the number of people who found the conspiracy because they were concerned with trafficking and then found themselves going down that path. So I guess the question then is, how much is this a conspiracy that starts off with a very rational concern, very empathetic concerns that then spins you down into areas that can be best described as not wholly rational, if not utterly irrational?
I think it's a very important question, and it's one that we try to address in great detail in the book. I'm not going to do it justice here, but it is absolutely clear in my mind that at the heart of every conspiracy theory, there is a kernel of truth that links it to a real news story out there, a real violation of public trust, a real conspiracy. So, whichever route a person may have taken to QAnon, and there's so many, trafficking is one, but then a lot of people I personally know started out very doubtful about the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry. And some of it had to do with this insane increase in prices of medical care at the same time as we're seeing decreases in quality of medical care, coupled with this loud and outrageous opioid scandal that exposed just how corrupt and callous and cynical this side of our life can be that we depend on very much. And so people start out with legitimate concerns and legitimate fears, and there is no effort on the side of, the government or the medical industry or the pharmaceutical industry to make things right. So they start looking in other directions. They go for essential oils, they go for spiritual healers, they go for religious, healing. And little by little, inch by inch, they end up in QAnon territory. Same thing with something like, flat earth and COVID denialism. It's another way to say, I don't trust science. I just don't trust what this community is going to sell to me next, because I've been burned before by people who are just interested in making money off of my inability to understand the technology, the digital media, the social media, the computers. We're so dependent now on all of these things that we're unable to really control. And so we can't understand when we're being taken advantage of. And that's a huge anxiety that we've been living with. And that for a lot of people, at this very vulnerable, unprecedented time of COVID, when we were all overwhelmed with anxiety and fear anyway, it just spilled into the search for some clarity, somebody they could trust that is not of the traditional ilk. And unfortunately, QAnon offered a lot of these things that people needed, this comfort, the certainty, the soothing, the community of people who are also concerned and are not going to paper over these violations that have taken place. And so, most people don't start making up conspiracy theories without some real deep grievances. And most of these grievances are traceable to some real problems that we've all lived through and, ended up having some hurt from.
Absolutely. And Mia Bloom, we've got about a minute left. How real is QAnon as a threat? Is this something that certainly you can lose friendships, you can lose, members of the family, to the conspiracy, but does it really pose legitimate threat, to the political order or to physical violence?
Well, so initially in 2019, and then again in 2020, Christopher Wray, the director of the FBI, said QAnon had the potential to be a terrorist threat. And this is partly because one of the early attacks happened on the Hoover Dam. And had he blown up the Hoover Dam, that would have constituted a terrorist attack. But then, of course, we had Merrick Garland and then Secretary Mayorkas from Department of Homeland Security reiterate this idea that QAnon followers might be so upset that none of their premonitions and their predictions have come true that they would turn to violence. And so part of the problem is, you know, this is the position that genuine terrorism scholars have taken for the last 20 years since 9/11, that we don't want to amplify the threat because it's beneficial to us to do so. You know, I follow the research of John Mueller at Ohio State, and he says you have a better chance of being hit by lightning twice than be killed by a terrorist. But yet, you know, people are constantly amping up the threat of terrorism. And so on the one hand, I can see that they don't want to downplay it significantly. But on the other hand, we've never had a terrorist movement that had 30 million followers. I mean, this would be, if it was actually potential for terrorism, we would be in very deep trouble. What I would say is that the people who on January 6th went to the Capitol and they were Patriot Front or Proud Boys or Boogaloo or militia or KKK, and they were also Q, the dangerous part was the first part of their, you know, their belief system. But if we start seeing a merger of QAnon with these actual domestic terrorist groups, then we will see a problem. But it's more of this, you know, forgive me for using intersectionality, but it would be more of this common frame. And, you know, we are starting to see some of the groups reaching out to QAnon, but that most QAnon people, as I mentioned, and, you know, I'm disaggregating them from the people who are monetizing it and manipulating them, like Sophia mentioned, most people, I think, went into QAnon for very good reasons. They thought they were helping. And I don't think the vast majority of people who believe in QAnon are also Nazis or Patriot Front or militia.
So the title of the book is Pastels and Pedophiles, Inside the QAnon Mind. The authors are Mia Bloom and Sophia Moskalenka, both connected with Georgia State University. We've just barely touched on so many of these issues. It is a rich book. It is a wonderfully researched book and certainly raises the importance of one of my takeaways from all of this, the need to teach and to advance critical analysis of any information that you receive, any information that you read online, as a means to try to ensure that you don't find yourself falling down the QAnon trap. Thank you both very much.
Thank you to our guests and to you for listening. The Scholar's Circle team includes Doug Becker, host, Ankine Agassian and Melissa Chiprin, managing producers, Sud Dongre, our webmaster. I'm Maria Armudian, and we'll see you next week.